Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Shopology podcast, where we bring you the latest in retail and marketing news, trends, and insights. I'm Dr. Jason Pallant, marketing and retail academic at Swinburne Business School, and I have the absolute pleasure of co-hosting this show with the amazing Dr. Louise Grimmer from the University of Tasmania. Welcome, Louise.
Hello, Jason. It's great to be with you again. I've missed you.
I know I've missed you as well. I've been out doing all of the shopping that I wasn't allowed to do for many, many months.
And good to hear.
So it's look, it's nice to have Melbourne Retail back. We'll get into that later in the show, but it's also nice to be back here. So big show as always. So this week we've got I did an interview with David Grant from Brickfields Consulting. We had a really, I think, fascinating discussion about what's happening in the property sector, particularly around retail. And if we think about, you know, shopping centers and physical retail stores, how they've been impacted and really what that means for the future. So that's coming up later on the show, but should we have a look at some of the retail news before we jump into that?
Let's do it.
Perfect. All right. So I'll kick us off. One of the big news stories, I think, from the last couple of weeks is the ABS, or the Australian Bureau of Statistics, obviously released their sales figures. We know that ABS are a couple of months behind, but I think what we're starting to see is really some of the impacts of the COVID pandemic on retail sales, but also something that we talk about in the interview later in this episode is around those different tiers of markets and the differences we're seeing across different states. So overall, the ABS for seasonally adjusted figures for September fell 1.1%, but that was following quite a few months of actual really large increases. One of the things that stood out to me was that the household goods category fell 7.4%, one of those big categories.
I thought that was really interesting too. I wonder if it's because people had already stocked up a lot on household goods, you know, when we sort of all went into that initial lockdown. What are your thoughts on that category?
Yeah, I think that too. That's what I saw. I was like, there's only so many cushions that you can have on your couch, and, you know, only so many things you can do to your house, right? So I think that was one of those categories that everybody focused on at the start of lockdowns, spending so much time at home. But
that's now, right.
Now our homes are all designer.
Beautiful. Yeah.
Get it out with everything.
Cozy cocoons.
Yeah, there's only so much we can eat. So what I think is going to be really interesting is starting to see, track the impacts in Victoria. Obviously, Victoria being in that really harsh lockdown and now being out, hooray. I'm hoping that we see a real recovery there, because I think that helps not only Victorian retailers, but, you know, really the whole country.
Yeah, absolutely. I can see with those figures, Jason, Victoria fell by just 0.4%, which I found surprising.
Yeah, I did too, until I looked into it, and I think that's because it was falling from such a low base. You know, so it's already fallen. There's not really much further it can go.
Yeah.
We've hit rock bottom, really, in terms of the retail sector, and so we're just going to start seeing the recovery, I think, which is actually going to be really exciting. Hopefully we start seeing some good news.
Absolutely. And of course, we're heading into that really, really important Christmas shopping season for retailers. I mean, it's important every year for retailers, but I think this, I would say arguably, this is the most important Christmas shopping period for retailers in history. And so I think, you know, you and I and others are looking for a real uptick in these sales figures, whether they're physical, whether they're online. Retailers are really, really keen to start to see consumers coming into their stores or shopping online, just to, especially in Victoria, to make up for what happened during that lockdown.
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned there, you know, whether it's physical or online. And I know you've got some news about, and you've been quoted recently about some of the big online sales that are going on. What's happening, Louise?
That's right. Yes. So in other news, Jason, we're recording this on a Monday and Click Frenzy starts tomorrow night, Tuesday, the 10th of November. There are about 800 or so retailers participating in this year's event. And I was interviewed by the wonderful Zona Black, who writes for The New Daily. And what was interesting about this year's event is that there are two car manufacturers this year who are getting involved, Subaru and Volkswagen. You can buy a car online this year via Click Frenzy, which is pretty interesting, isn't it? Would you buy a car on Click Frenzy? I'm tempted, I've got to say.
Well, look, I mean, if you needed a new car, I guess if you can get it at a discount, that's great. I mean, we actually earlier in the year were looking at getting a second car and then went into lockdown and haven't even driven our first one. So I'm not going to be buying a car at the moment, but it is really interesting to just see. I think if you think back a few years in terms of online retail and you know, we just thought that these some categories were just never going to work. You know, some categories you just need to see and experience. And, you know, we just, so many categories keep bucking that trend and showing us that consumers are willing to shop online if they can get a good discount for it.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And I sort of have a thought about Click Frenzy. I think it's going to go one of two ways, and I'm really not sure. I think on one hand, consumers are very used to shopping online now. You know, a lot of people were forced to shop online when the country went into lockdown, and particularly in Victoria. All of those sort of barriers that a lot of people experienced previously, reasons why they didn't want to shop online, were really removed because we had to. And so we might see people think, well, you know what, I've test driven a car. If one of these brands of car is having a good sale price as part of Click Frenzy, well, you know, why not? Or the other is that maybe this year people have got a bit of online shopping fatigue. And, you know, if you think about consumers in Victoria where you are desperate to get out of the house offline and into physical stores. So I'm not sure how Click Frenzy is going to go this year. I think it's either going to be a huge success, or a lot of people might just think, you know, I'm sick of shopping online. I'm actually going to head into stores this year. But we'll see. It starts 7 o'clock tomorrow night, Tuesday the 10th of November, and it runs through until Thursday.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm definitely in that online shopping fatigue category that you mentioned. If we never buy another thing online again, I'll be pretty happy. Even just from, I mean, so many challenges we've experienced here with deliveries. You know, like there's just been so many delays that I think it's actually created quite a negative experience for a lot of consumers.
I agree. Just by way of adding to that Click Frenzy story, Click Frenzy have actually partnered this year with Couriers Please. Now, they're a private postal company, and what Zona was alluding to in her article was perhaps this is some sort of acknowledgement that there have been problems with delays that have plagued Australia Post this year. I'm using the word unprecedented, but you're right. If you are shopping online and you've had a great online experience, all of that can come undone if there are delays with delivery, even if your goods are not packaged the way that you think they should be. There are all sorts of other things that can go wrong as soon as you sort of hit buy and pay on the online site. So it'll be interesting to keep an eye on it, I guess, and see how successful it is this year.
Yeah, watch this space.
And in other news, Woolworths have reported a sales boom. Now, they've attributed this to two things. One is unsurprising, the COVID-19 pandemic. But the other factor that they've attributed their success to is the Ooshies campaign, the Ooshies promotion, which, you know, we've probably gone out of our collective minds, I guess, with COVID sort of taken over everything. But Woolworths has said that the Ooshies promotion has really bolstered a sales surge, which was prompted by the stay-at-home culture sparked by COVID-19. And Jared Cockburn has been writing about this in news.com. Woolworths have reported a total group sales figure of $17.9 billion across its supermarket and leisure brands for the first 3 months of the financial year 2021. And Brad Banducci, the chief executive of Woolworths, has clearly highlighted that the cult-like popularity of its Ooshies promotion really did help push sales up over the quarter. So, you know, I've written about plastic promotions in the conversation previously. There's no doubt, you know, they have their detractors, but there's no doubt that they also have their supporters. I don't know if you had Ushies in your house. Your little one's probably a bit young, Jason, but it was certainly a very, very successful campaign for Woolworths and has contributed to these strong sales figures.
Yeah, we've avoided the cult of the Ushies so far, thankfully. I do keep getting asked about them at the checkout, and I see people doing it. And, you know, I guess from a psychological standpoint, you can understand that, you know, exclusivity and not wanting to miss out and trying to get that whole collection, and that can be really appealing, particularly to, you know, young kids. If it's, you know, the Lion King ones, or I saw there was some sort of Marvel Avengers ones, I think, which I almost thought about for a second, but still avoided. But yeah, it's interesting. I wouldn't have thought that that would be enough to really push giant sales growth at a supermarket, but no, there you go.
I know, it's just the pester power, I think. I'm the mother of a 9-year-old boy, and they were certainly very popular at his school, but, you know, for a very short period of time. So that's it for the news this week, Jason.
It is. I mean, there's plenty of other retail news, but we don't have time to cover all of it. But we do our best at highlighting what we think some of the bigger issues and some of the deeper insights that we can draw from those news stories. And speaking of deeper insights, let's have a listen to the interview that I did now just over a week ago with David Grant, who's one of the directors at Brickfields Consulting. David and I have crossed paths many times in the past through our mutual work with particularly retail shopping centre operators. So I've done a lot of research in the past looking at, you know, retailer and landlord relationships and trends within physical retail spaces, obviously. And so came across David at Brickfields, which was previously called Place Associates. And they do a lot of that work and consulting with property groups and property owners. And so really interesting chat that we have around the impact that, you know, the COVID-19 pandemic has had, not just on retail, but specifically within a physical store and shopping center environment, and some of the predictions for what that's going to look like moving forward. So let's have a listen. David, thank you so much for taking some time out to chat with me on Shopology. It's a pleasure. It's always interesting to hear your views. Obviously, you and I have known each other for quite a while through a variety of different roles and in different contexts. So for the listeners, do you want to just give you a little bit of an introduction to yourself, your background, and how you're spending your time currently?
Yeah, sure. Thank you for the invitation to be here, Jason. So my background is in sort of a market research background, specifically looking at helping the owners and operators of physical places and spaces better understand their customers. So we work specifically in the property sector, of which retail is a component of the work that we do. And I basically lead the research arm of Brickfields Consulting. So the quantitative and qualitative research in both of those fields generally try and help our clients better understand who they're designing their experiences for. The logic being that if they can understand who that's for, then they're far more likely to attract the right audience, to get that audience to come back more often, to spend more time, to spend more money, to potentially be better and stronger advocates and more loyal in their behaviour for physical places.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And as I said, we, you know, that interest in really understanding customers is how you and I got connected and where we overlap. And it's always fun for me, coming more from that academic side, to be working with, you know, people in industry who are as fascinated as I am about understanding consumers. So it's always been a pleasure. I guess what I want to start with today is just, you know, talking about the property sector. And if we think, you know, specifically about retail, I mean, it's been obviously such a roller coaster, but particularly for physical environments where we've seen a variety of different restrictions across Australia. You know, we're sitting here, we're recording here today, the day before Melbourne retail shops are allowed to open again. And I'm very excited to actually go to a physical shop, which I haven't done for months. So I guess from your view, what have you seen
from your clients and your partners around some of the biggest challenges they've faced?
Yeah, well, obviously, I mean, anyone who said that they knew that 2020 was going to turn out this way would be lying. It's been a massive shock to the property industry and to retail as well. I don't think anyone anticipated, I guess, the depth of the interruption and also the length of the interruption. And we've got to keep in mind we're only probably partway through. If the end goal is widespread vaccination or access to vaccination, that's probably going to be mid next year before that seems to be the case. So obviously it's been a huge shock overall to the industry. The first few months, I think many people will be able to relate to this. Our clients were basically just shocked. We were all fairly unsure of what to expect, where things would go, how quickly things would happen. The first onset in March was very sudden in terms of the lockdowns across Australia and even the world at that point in time. So for a lot of our clients, it was just about basically taking stock and being able to just take a moment to think about where things were going. And that really didn't happen until probably the end of April. Added to that within retail, you know, clearly we saw a massive uplift in that supermarket trade for those essential items. What some people probably would have referred to as hoarding in key kind of categories. And we saw that in the research that we ran. We ran retail research in April and then again in the beginning of June. And that research really showed a dramatic shift in people's buying patterns, some serious alarm and uncertainty in their perceptions in April. And then probably it wasn't until the end of May, the beginning of June, that things started to normalize a little bit. And I think at this point in time, it's probably fair to say that for most Australians, it's where there was a bit of divergence. So we have basically three different speeds of retail experience, so to speak. We've got, Victoria that never really came out of lockdown fully before then going back into lockdown. And a lot of our research would suggest that it is its own market dealing with its own challenges right now. And then there's obviously New South Wales, which was sort of a more advanced version of Victoria and certainly has had more challenges as a larger population as the central port where people are returning to. It has some of those challenges of a big city. And retail has been restricted but not as impacted as it has been in Victoria. And then obviously the rest of Australia. So you've got three tiers of retail experience there, probably starting from the beginning of June onwards. And to this point, Jason, obviously it's great that everyone in Melbourne and in Victoria more broadly is able to go into physical stores, is able to have those retail experiences that the rest of Australia has been having. But it just goes to show how divergent those three markets are. Many of your listeners will probably have relationships in other states of Australia. And certainly when you speak to operators in other states, in Queensland, in Western Australia, South Australia, and even Tasmania, there's a sense that it's business as usual as far as they're concerned. Obviously, the customer profile has changed a fair bit. But for all intents and purposes, they consider it almost to be business as usual. So it's kind of interesting seeing where that divergence now lies. And I think at this point in time, what we're really hoping is that Victoria and New South Wales can integrate with the rest of Australia, and that we can largely have free movement between the states in somewhat controlled way in that COVID normal kind of way. But that we can basically over the next 3 months leading into Christmas have some sort of alignment from a retail point of view. And if we achieve that, we're doing really well considering how divergent those three markets are at the moment.
Yeah, you, as you were saying that, like it flipped into my mind that like I've been, you know, living in Melbourne, I'm so now just in this bubble with, for want of a better word, of you know, just stores not being open and not being able to go more than 5 kilometres from a house. And it's hard to then picture that in other states that's, you know, that's not the case. People are just still going to shops.
Not everyone's queuing up for haircuts at midnight like they were in Melbourne the other day when stores reopened. I don't know if I'd trust a hairdresser at 1 o'clock in the morning to cut my hair. But yeah, not everyone's in that same situation. I can understand why it's such a central part of the Victorian existence. I mean, so much of the culture of Victoria is founded around those sorts of retail high street experiences. And, you know, particularly with food and beverage. And I can see why the desire is to return and why people are so excited and why so many restaurants are booked out weeks in advance now. And I don't know, you've got a brunch booked in for 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. You probably did never imagine that you'd be so eager to book in a 9 a.m. brunch on a weekday morning. But, yeah, that's the nature of where we're at in Victoria. But, you know, as for the rest of Australia, I think it shows what's possible if you can get on top of the numbers. And it then shows that, you know, we can open retail up and we can have, for the most part, have a really similar experience to what we might have had previously, probably just with those minor amendments. Things like, for instance, mingling within social environments, bars, restaurants and so on. You know, they're the sorts of things that we won't be able to do probably until mid-next year. But 95% of what we would otherwise want to do within a retail environment, we should be able to do if we can all align the practices across the rest of Australia.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. I think one thing that is really interesting from this, you know, we talk about this divergence, but, you know, if you're a property operator or property owner and some of the bigger groups I'm thinking of, you know, it must be so challenging of having to keep up with what's happening in all of those different areas and adapt accordingly. I mean, in Melbourne, we've been hanging on, you know, daily announcements of which day is it going to be that retail reopens? You know, how are we going to, when is it going to be? What's it going to look like? There's just been so much uncertainty. I mean, how do you, as a retailer or a property operator, you know, adapt and be able to adjust your strategies across those different locations and, you know, across time as things change?
Yeah, it's a really good point. I mean, it's very hard when you're dealing with national chains. It's very hard to have 3 or 4 or 5 different operational requirements, you know, the opening hours, the number of people in the store, the processes around providing a COVID safe environment. And probably it's fair to say that the more aligned those practices can be and the requirements can be across the whole of Australia, if you're a national brand, the easier it's going to be to reopen and to gain momentum and to do all of that sort of stuff that you need to do. I mean, there's a staff training component to that as well, which is a bit of a challenge. If things are changing all the time, then you obviously need to communicate that not only to your staff but to your customers as well. There's a degree of kind of moral and social obligation that your customers are having to assume that they might not have had to assume before in terms of, you know, washing hands or, you know, sanitizing hands, you know, on entry and so on, staying socially distant from staff and from other customers, you know, not over-touching product, for instance. There are all sorts of things that that every national brand has got to deal with. And obviously across Australia, there's variations in recommendation depending on how serious the threat is. So I would hope that going forward that there would be a unified kind of approach within the country and that as a result that we might start to see a bit more harmony between retailers and landlords as well. There's been a tremendous period of tension. And some retailers obviously have been, you know, retail categories have been really affected during this period and others less so. But overall, it's been a period of 6 months of extreme tension between retailers and landlords. And really the point that you would probably agree with, I would imagine, Jason, is that everyone's in it together. And it certainly doesn't help the landlord if the retailer doesn't recognise that there's a degree of mutual responsibility that both parties hold to trying to find the best possible solution for this sort of challenging situation.
Yeah, I think you're totally right there. I mean, as you know, as we've interacted over time. Like in a previous role, I set up one of the industry benchmark studies around retailer landlord relationships, you know, and talking to different retailers and how they found their relationship with all of the sort of major property groups. And as you said, I mean, one of the biggest predictors, I guess, we found of satisfaction with those relationships is the sense that there was a willingness or a desire to, you know, work together and collaborate, mm-hmm. you know, because both the landlord and the retailer benefit by having greater footfall in center, right? You know,
yeah.
more people in center, people benefit. And, you know, both benefit when those people come in and they find an engaging, interesting experience that leads them to want to shop with the retailers that are in there and, yeah. and that kind of thing. And it's been interesting seeing the tension and going, you know, I feel like this is a time more than ever that retailers and landlords really need to work together. But, you know, from what you're seeing, how does that happen?
Well, yeah, I mean, it certainly doesn't happen by landlords boarding up shops and evicting retailers and retailers conversely deciding not to open because it's not worth their time or their effort. I think it's about, as you say, going in there with a unified mindset and recognizing that from a customer experience and perception point of view, both parties play a very significant role, almost like a 50-50, within the overall perception and reason of why someone would want to visit. So I think what it's about is basically open lines of communication, making sure that the requests are reasonable, that there's a degree of sympathy for retailers in certain situations and maybe accommodations for them. If you feel like, for instance, hospitality, food and beverage retailers just can't viably open, then that's a different story from other retailers that are choosing not to open because they're waiting for, you know, the momentum to return within the market. So I think it's about making sure that there's a critical mass of retailers that are open, that it presents as best it possibly can as business as usual, and that everyone recognizes that you're all in it together. You're bricks within a wall. As soon as one retailer decides that they're going to protest and do something a different way or not participate, not open, then ultimately it has an impact on the negative perception across the whole entire center or the retail destination. I know that sounds like a simplistic approach, but maybe you've got to reach rock bottom, which is where we're at, before people start recognizing that they need to cooperate. So that sort of militant sort of approach is probably not going to be helpful for either the retailer or for the landlord.
Yeah, I agree totally. I mean, what sort of have you seen any good examples or some successful strategies that, you know, your clients or partners have been employing, whether that is around that idea of trying to collaborate between retailers and landlords or just more generally of, you know, how to encourage consumers to, you know, come and shop within physical retail environments?
Yeah, I think, look, in the early days, it was very much around two strategies. It was around bringing the product to the customer was a key strategy. And so there was lots around delivery services, businesses, you know, offering takeaway or delivery services for their products, whether that was food and beverage or just general merchandise. So that's definitely one strategy. The other strategy was sort of quite interesting around product diversification, which we saw with a number of retailers sort of branching out. I mean, it was kind of interesting to see that, you know, the pubs became general stores. There was almost this like return to the Wild West nostalgia of retailing where everyone retailed everything. As we became less likely to go longer distances and stay more local, then we needed a bigger range of products and services within our local community. So hence that diversification kind of occurred. And I think that there are two trends that will continue. They were sort of already happening before COVID, but COVID has sped them up. And if there's anything I can say to reassure your listeners, it's that what we're going down is not a path that, even though it was unexpected, it's not a path from a retail point of view that was particularly unexpected. I think what's generally happened is that a number of practices that are emerging in a more widespread way were practices that were probably more niche or fringe that were going to become more mainstream over time. And all that's happened is that those practices have become more mainstream more quickly. So there's still a role for physical retail. The death of the mall is, or the demise of the mall is very much overstated. So I can reassure your listeners and say that there is definitely that role for physical, but we need to get back to making sure that what we're providing is where and when and how the customer wants it. So yes, the physical store plays a role, but then there's also components around that sort of bringing product to them and diversifying the actual offer, both on site as well as through that sort of delivery kind of service. In terms of, to answer your question around the in-store experience, I mean, you know, that's a bit different. I've kind of been talking about the delivery of a product or a service outside of the store, but in the store, very much we need to be practicing things that support a feeling of safety and reassurance. So a lot of retailers in New South Wales and in other states of Australia that have been open during this period have got signage and signifiers on their shopfront to talk about COVID safe practices, whether that's part of a national kind of, you know, Amex style endorsed program or whether that's handwritten signs that they've made themselves. But just making sure that people understand that that is a practice that's occurring within that environment, that there's obviously adequate hand sanitizer to be used both in and entering as well as exiting the store. Possibly also signs within the store to communicate what they can and can't do, what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. Signs around the numbers of people, the movement that we've seen within office buildings in particular. So this is an entry point, this is an exit point. And we've seen that as well in discount department stores. So they're the main things that are not rocket science, but they go a long way to reassuring customers that not only are they being told what to do themselves, but they're also aware that other customers are being told how to behave. And that gives them reassurance that there's not going to be people that are breaking the rules in a negligent way.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things you mentioned there, which I thought was interesting, was talking about how, you know, what we're seeing is a lot of things that were niche becoming a bit more mainstream. You mentioned earlier you've been, you know, doing some research around shifting of consumer shopping habits. I mean, what do you see being the longer term impacts? You know, what are the behaviors or shifts that you think are going to stay and what are more temporary, I guess?
I think it's, I'd probably break it down into the three C's that, you know, probably answer most of what's emerging within retail. So the first C is around convenience. And that's about essentially associated with providing people with what they want, where they want, when they want in a timely manner. But the location of the delivery of the service is just as important as the timeliness with that convenience point. The second one is around customization. And I think that's going to, you know, obviously be facilitated through technology to a large extent, but it might not be. It might also be through old-fashioned face-to-face service and knowing people's names and so on. But making sure that the right sort of experience is given to the right sort of customer, that you feel that it's tailored, that it's exclusive as a result of that. And as I said, technology largely enables that to occur. And then the final one is looking more at the idea of community. And I think that the final community point is probably the area where we're going to see the most amount of change. Convenience and customization was occurring within retail, you know, to a large extent for the last, you know, 5 years or so. Whereas community was one that you probably were only seeing emerge through examples like the Brickworks development, Burwood by Fraser's property. That typifies that sort of community point, something that's hyper-local, that has been designed around the needs of the immediate community, that fulfills that role of what retail really provided, you know, even thousands of years ago, that kind of the town square, the, you know, the gathering space, the place to go. There's a word in Greek, agora, which it has a really interesting meaning, and it sort of talks to not only a retail kind of heart, but also a place where people gather and share ideas and knowledge with that it's not just about exchanging of the goods. It's really about a gathering spot where people feel comfortable and they dwell. And I think that that talks to what the future of community needs to be within a retail setting. It needs to be something beyond just the exchange of goods, because as we've just discussed, those goods can be delivered anywhere. So the tentacles of a retail mall might stretch well beyond their physical bounds. But inversely, there's a role for retail malls to play around inviting people in to become that sort of community heart, and offering a diversification of retail experiences or just experiences generally. So whether it's sharing of knowledge, education, enrichment, whether it's civic purposes, whether it's town square purposes associated with that. It could also be fitness, well-being, personal services. You know, it could even be co-living type of use within that town square as well. So they're the three things that I think are really emerging and are going to last the test of time. I think in particular that community piece will become something that becomes increasingly important. All of us have been asked to reconnect with our immediate locality, and I think we've seen some benefits to that. The idea of kind of living and working and shopping within a small area. There was a study, you'd probably be aware of this, Jason, called it was a study out of the US that was done around happiness before happiness was a buzzword, and it looked at the three major places where people shopped, worked, and where they lived. And there was a triangle, obviously, between those three places that you could draw. And the smaller the radius of the circle around those three places, the happier the person was. And obviously it makes sense, because the less time you spend traveling to work or home, then probably the happier you're going to be with your lifestyle. But I think that goes to the heart of what the future of a post-COVID retail world is all about. It's all about that hyper-local, making sure that it's all personalized and customized to your needs, and also that it's highly convenient. So they're the three things that I'd probably be looking for as markers of the retail landscape in 2021 onwards.
Yeah, I love it. You know, I love anything where it's, you know, three C's, the four or seven P's of marketing, anything that we can get with, you know, that I could see that being on a lecture slide or in a textbook. Already, so I'll quote you when we inevitably use that one. The community idea, I think, is fascinating, and you brought up the example of Burwood Brickworks. I mean, I was fortunate to see some of the plans for that as it was in development, and was blown away with it as a just, you know, as you said, that idea of it becoming such a hub for the community and not necessarily being, you know, having a massive number of retail stores within it, but just being so tailored and specific to that community. It actually changed, you know, my family's shopping behavior. We started driving, you know, further and past lots of other grocery stores and cafes and everything to go there, because it just felt nice to be in that place, and it had everything that we need. I mean, the question for you, you're talking about hyper-local and keeping everything close. What does this do to CBD locations, either in terms of, you know, places for work, but also thinking about them as, you know, usually such retail destinations and so much invested within CBDs. If we're all going to be staying within our local areas, are we seeing a fundamental shift as to, you know, where retail is actually going to be located?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's an interesting one. We have done research around the impact of COVID for office towers, which are predominantly located in capital city CBD settings. And it would appear that once you crunch the numbers, that there is about 60% of professional workers believe that their business will permanently change their working from home policy in 12 months, within the next 12 months. And then you look at how much they think they're going to be increasing their working from home as a result of that, which is probably an additional day or day and a half a week. So they might go from 1 day a week or 0 days a week to two or possibly even three. And then you look at the impact of that on the numbers of people that would be coming into a city location, and you realize very quickly that this is going to have a tapered impact on retail turnover for those CBD locations. That really what we'll see for probably the next 5 years before we start embarking upon greater levels of density in the city is a fairly flatlined kind of number of customers and spend as a result. So this is probably not that much of a surprise, but it's very much linked to the working from home idea. The fact that what this has done is it's blown away the cover for many businesses to say that people that work from home can't do their jobs effectively and can't do it productively. And the research would suggest that we've done into this space that not only can they be just as productive, but they think they can be just as effective working from home as working from the office. And as a result, it's sort of taken away that excuse for many employers to justify why someone needs to be in the office 5 days a week. So going forward, it will be an interesting one to see what happens. But CBD retail will undoubtedly have some challenging years ahead, in particular, not so much the big ticket kind of destinational retailers within the city, because I think people will still go into the city for those experiences. But I think it's going to be more the food and beverage and the worker-related retail that's going to be most impacted.
Yeah, I think there's some fascinating implications if we think through it there of, you know, just rental agreements in the CBD retail and how expensive it can be to operate a store or a cafe or a restaurant there. If we see those footfalls changing, this goes back to our point earlier about, you know, retailers and landlords really needing to work together to say, well, how do we survive this and how do we create a compelling CBD experience if we can't rely on, as we say, workers just walking by on their lunch break? How do we encourage people to come to the CBD as a destination and create that experience? I think it's going to be fascinating to look at how that plays out.
Oh, it would be, it's almost like a return to the old. And what's really interesting around COVID-19 is how many of these sort of trends are simply reflections of practices that might have happened 50, 60, 70, 100, even 400 years ago. That idea of the big day out, getting dressed up, going to the city, you know, that's what it feels like when you go into an office building now in Sydney. You go into the city, it's your one day a week and you wear your suit and you get all dressed up and it feels like a special occasion. It's probably very reminiscent of the 1950s and 60s in, you know, middle ring suburban life in Australia. But, you know, many of these things have throwbacks. Even the other day I was kind of reading an article about the fact that Italian restaurants have started using their wine windows, which were largely built into the fabric of these restaurants in the 1600s as a solution to serving customers during the Black Plague. And so they have these little hatches that you can obviously deliver wine in a glass through to a customer, through to a drinker. And they haven't used them for, you know, 400 plus years. And suddenly now they've got a purpose. So it's funny to think about how much of this is a reflection of what might have happened in the past. Even the idea of community, what we were just talking about. I mean, a lot of that, really, we could say that maybe 100 to maybe 50 years ago, we had a much stronger sense of community, localized community than we've had in the last 50 years. And maybe a resurgence to that is simply returning back to, or the pendulum shifting back to those sorts of values that have been lost in the modern age.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point around, you know, what I've seen, and particularly just from a personal standpoint, is, you know, this whole experience has made me really see what is actually important in my life. And that's, you know, the health and safety of my family and my friends is number one by a very long, far way. And so, you know, it's fundamentally changed, you know, the kind of things that we were doing, how we were spending our time. You know, we're now so appreciative of being able to just, you know, spend time in our garden you know, go for walks in our local area, and noticing that, you know, we love that we have some local cafes we can go and walk and get takeaway at. You know, we don't need to go out for, you know, a huge restaurant or go out to, you know, clubs or any of that kind of stuff. It's just, we just want to spend time with our family. I think that to me is the fascinating bit around changing a lot of people's priorities. I think it's going to It's going to be interesting over the next few years to see what the flow-on effects of that are. Now, your team recently released a report around nimble neighbourhoods, and you know, which I think fits with this theme around, you know, places becoming more local and inclusive. You know, what are you observing? What did you find in those sort of areas?
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to what we're seeing within retail. And if there's anything I can say, it's that over time, since we've been publishing these trends reports in the last 10 years, it's very obvious that there's a blurring between each of the different typologies of place. So retail has less distinctive aspects to it than it used to. Likewise, residential and commercial. Very few places are conceived as single use types of places. You know, an office building will have a retail component to it. It might have a lifestyle component to it. It might even be mixed hotel workplace as well. So what we're finding overall is that the trends from, say, where we want to live in our local neighbourhoods is having an impact on retail and on the perceptions of what people want. The things that we found that were quite interesting was that, as you say, that those sorts of old-fashioned values are really coming back in, that there's a role for technology to play in bringing that all together and making sure that we connect with the people that we're most likely to have relationships with. The physical spaces play a really important role too, that there's only so far that you can do to build a relationship that's purely done through digital means, that we need physical spaces. We have an inherent desire to socialize and to interact. And as such, our neighborhoods probably need to adjust their approach to how they're designed and how they're laid out. So for instance, gone are the days of the sort of McMansion where we have, you know, everything enclosed within our massive houses that happen to be the second biggest footprint on average in the world. We don't need the home cinema, you know, in the basement, which we use only once a year. We want to have communal spaces where we have an outdoor, you know, open air cinema, and that during summer months, the community puts that on for everyone, and every Friday and Saturday night, we all gather together and we have those sorts of shared experiences. They're the sorts of things that, although very simple, are emerging desires within the market, you know, to share in experiences with other people that happen to be local, that happen to be meaningful or distinctive, rather than those sort of more, I guess, enclosed, private, contained, almost selfish and individualistic experiences. And maybe that's a result of COVID-19. You know, you would know better than most. How many days was it in lockdown, Jason?
119, I found out from the radio this morning. Just to really rub it into us. Yep.
Oh, well, at least you heard it on the radio. I was concerned when you said it before that you'd actually counted it yourself, and I was a bit worried that you might have been a bit preoccupied by it. But I can understand why, after 100 and something days, that people want to spend more time with other people, that they want to actually get out of their houses. And that was really what Nimble Neighbourhoods is all about, those sorts of environments that change really quickly, that allow people to influence and to decide their kind of design and their operation, take a sense of ownership. And, you know, it's kind of like the classic public park, I suppose. You know, that the way that was designed was as a shared space where people came together years and years ago. I think we're now realizing the importance of those types of spaces and how we need lots of those spaces to be not just public parks, but variants of shared communal spaces, like the common cafe that spills out in the street. That serves a role socially within our lives. So really interesting trends, and I think it's going to become more important over time. I think the amount of time we've all spent at home has made us relook at what we want from life, what we want from our local communities, and what we want from the retailers that serve us within that community.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, personally, this actually really excites me, this idea of, you know, this getting back to some community focus and retail playing that role of bringing people together, you know, not just being about a transactional exchange of a money for a good or a service, but playing a role in people's lives and in local communities. Because I think, to me, that's, you know, that's how we start as a domestic retail market competing with some of the giants in this space, like your Amazons, that you can buy something online and they'll deliver it to you, but it's so transactional, that interaction. You know, I think, to me, that opportunity is, you know, that experience and being part of actually people's lives. You know, that's my sense of how we actually start strengthening our domestic retail market, which has obviously been through a lot of challenges.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think there's enough great brands out there to demonstrate that if you provide people with something that they want, that they truly want in a way in which they'd expect it, they will pay a premium for it. And they're not going to just price match you with Amazon. If you can provide them with, you know, that sort of experience, then you're going to create a retail offer which is, you know, impervious to these sorts of ups and downs. You know, there's some really good examples of brands that are embracing that sort of more modern thinking, linking omnichannel in with their approach. I mean, there's a great example of a restaurant in New York which, during the middle of the pandemic, still managed to turn over roughly the same amount of money. It's a restaurant called 11 Madison Park, and they were selling $275, that's US dollars, meal kits that you would make yourself at home. That was obviously a curated menu from their chefs, and obviously used very fine ingredients and whatnot. But that's the price that they were getting per couple who were dining in. And they're actually managing to lower their overheads and not have to pay for the service staff and for the electricity and for everything else that you would imagine with a dine-in experience, and sold just as much to people to make within their own homes. So it's a really interesting example of that sort of, you know, no matter what COVID throws at us, we'll try and think of something a bit different that builds our brand still and allows us to keep going forward. And obviously it was a great product, otherwise it wouldn't have been successful.
Mm. That type of you know, rapid innovation of seeing a trend and saying, you know, this is a role that we can play, or this is how we can still be providing a service, and, you know, and getting back to that core need. And yes, people can't dine in, but, you know, if you can still experience that quality experience and food, and you know, I think there was a bit of that novelty, wasn't it, early on, of sort of, you know, I'm making my own thing from this restaurant. I saw a lot of people posting those kind of things of, you know, date night at home with their, their meal kits. It's really interesting.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, but I mean, even, you know, for other businesses that are challenged beyond these times, I mean, there's so many examples of where retailers overseas in particular have managed to almost come out of COVID stronger, more resilient, more diversified as a result of the challenges that they've had to face. So it's not all doom and gloom. I would encourage your listeners, and I'm sure you would as well, to, you know, be inspired by the sort of cutting edge practices of the leading brands and retailers that managed to turn a challenge into a positive.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, and let's hope we can do that, because, you know, I think we all benefit from having a really good, engaging Australian retail market. Such a big impact on, you know, the overall economy and jobs and just society as a whole. So
I think and the impact I heard this morning around, you know, Victorian job losses. I mean, to give you an idea of that divergence that we were talking about at the beginning of the discussion, I mean, Victoria was losing 1,200 jobs a day during this period. And if you look at the rest of Australia was putting on 2,000 jobs a day. So, you know, I'm hoping that now that Victoria's well and truly turned the corner and is reopening, that we'll start to see an incredible retail market in Melbourne in particular, you know, really show what's possible in this sort of constrained and challenging environment. Letting them open and letting them show their stuff, you know, with, I think, the best food and beverage offer in the country, if not the region. arguably the world, but other categories that are very strong in Melbourne. So it'd be great to see what Victoria in particular does over the next 3 months leading into Christmas.
Yeah, absolutely. And I'll be one of those people that is in there frequenting my my local retailers and cafes to, you know, I have to. It's for the good of the community and the economy. It's not me treating myself. you know, doing my role. I think, look, that's a really positive note for us to end on there. I'll say thank you so much, David, for your time and your insights. I mean, for the listeners who are interested in, you know, hearing more about these trends and your, you know, some of the research that you've been doing around consumers and places, where can they go to find you or access any of those sort of insights that you've got?
Yeah, sure. I mean, if you go to our company website, so it's brickfields.com, just.com, you can go into a section there that's reports, and all of our trends reports, as well as the COVID research that I mentioned earlier from the April as well as the June edition, are available to download for free. So, yeah, that's the place to go.
Excellent. And we will be, of course, tagging you and Brickfields when we release the episode. So people will be able to follow you along for all of those insights. So, David, thank you again. Let's hope next time we chat, you know, things are looking up in retail, particularly for Victoria, and we've had a great Christmas.
Yeah, indeed. Thank you for your time, everyone.
Well, there you go. That was my chat with David Grant from Brickfields Consulting. Always a pleasure, as I said in that interview, to talk to people who, you know, are as interested as I am about trying to understand consumers, understand really those insights, but coming at it from a different perspective. You know, obviously that practitioner angle and working for specific clients and partners, it's always rejuvenating for me to sort of get some of those on the ground insights and talk to people. I think one of the big topics I think was really interesting from that was that idea of things becoming so much more local, and that small radius decreasing. You know, Dave spoke about the, you know, the triangle idea between the distance between where you work, where you live, and, you know, where your community or where your shopping is, and the smaller those are, the happier you are. I thought that was a really interesting idea, and I mean, I've been living that in Melbourne, where we've had to have a 5 kilometer radius but around everything. And even as the radius has opened up, I mean, we haven't immediately jumped out and driven to regional Victoria or driven, you know, ages away from our house apart from seeing friends, because we've discovered, you know, these local cafes and the local shops and our local community, and we're seeing the spoonbills. And I know this is an area you're really passionate about, Louise, is that shopping local.
That's right. I'm a massive small shops enthusiast and have been a local shopping champion or enthusiast for quite some time. And I think the good thing about you and I being co-hosts of this podcast is that we live in two very different areas. So you're in Melbourne in Victoria and I'm in Hobart in Tasmania, where the retailing really is very different, because where I live, we don't have huge shopping centres. We don't have the range and choice and just number of retailers that you have there in Melbourne. And so a lot of my experience is local shopping. They're really... you know, there isn't a lot of choice, but I do it by choice because I want to support those smaller stores. I think it's much more pleasant. And it was really, I mean, I found that interview just fantastic to listen to and really fascinating. And I guess it just confirmed a lot of the things that I've been thinking and researching about for a while now, I guess. One of the other things that I found really interesting early on in that interview, Jason, was I guess you were both really speaking to the importance of the social and experiential and physical nature of retailing, hospitality and services. You know, just how desperate people in Victoria in particular have been to actually go to physical bricks and mortar stores, because there's something about that way of shopping that we crave as humans, I think. And I think, you know, that really sort of came through in that interview early on. But the other two interesting points that I took, I mean, it was all fascinating, but I think where you spoke, David spoke about the challenge for larger property owners where they've got centres in different parts of the country. You know, he spoke about there were really sort of early on three tiers of retailing across the country. There was Victoria, there was New South Wales, and then there was the rest of Australia where it's sort of been business as usual, as it certainly has been here in Tasmania where I am. But he was speaking about the challenges of, you know, if you're a national retailer trying to operate multiple stores in those across those three different tiers, it's a real challenge to have those different operational requirements. And I think we've certainly seen that with retailing in Victoria. And then I guess the final point that I just wanted to raise was that talking about that tremendous tension that has existed between landlords and retailers and just the sheer importance of trying to work together, trying to have that spirit of cooperation, and the feeling that we are all in this together and we sort of do need to help each other. I think that was really interesting too. And of course, he comes at it from another perspective, which is always great to hear.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the key takeaways that I think is really crucial, I would argue, to the survival of our retail market and particularly our domestic local retailers. I think that's the area where I see such an opportunity and a need for, you know, shopping centre operators and retailers to work together, because, you know, we're seeing not only at the moment, you know, the pandemic has forced us to shop online a lot more, but I think even before that, we were seeing consumers move to giant international brands at the expense of our local domestic market. You know, we've seen your Uniqlo's and your H&M's and your Zara's. If we think about the fast fashion, you know, you talk about large shopping centres. I live right next to Chadstone, and it's just increasingly becoming international flagship brands, which can be appealing and it can be different, but you know, a lot of those profits then are going back overseas and not really supporting our domestic economy as much as, you know, your local independent retailer that you might see in a strip around a corner. So I think that's the area where, you know, shopping centre operators and retailers really need to think about what is the long-term sustainable solution? How do we encourage consumers to keep coming to those social experiential places that you mentioned, and not costing out domestic retailers from the market, which we're seeing.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've all been, you know, when we could travel, we've all been to, you know, those sort of towns where it's just a cookie cutter full of national chain stores. There's nothing really of great interest. And then you'll go to some other location, which is chock full of those local, unique, boutique, small independent stores. And the difference in the shopping experience, but just the general overall experience of those areas is just so marked. And that's why I'm just, you know, really keen, especially this Christmas, that people who are listening to this podcast, when you're thinking about doing your Christmas shopping, please try and think about what might be the local alternative where you could shop for the products that you're looking for. It might be that you're shopping with a local retailer online using their online store. That's fine, however you want to do it. But just to really be cognizant of the power of your spend and how powerful it is where you choose to spend your money this Christmas, because it really is going to be such an important period this Christmas for local retailers. And I do sort of bang on about this a bit, but we don't want to lose them. You don't want to lose those small independent stores from your local area, because we don't want empty stores. That's awful. But we also don't just want a whole raft of international or national chain stores. We really want to try and support those local retailers, because they really give life to the places that we live and the places that we work and the places that we want to be.
Absolutely. Well said, Louise. So, look, before we wrap up, we're going to trial a new segment. We are calling this Bargain, Rip Off and Gift with Purchase. Now, Louise, this was your idea and coming from some of your radio background. So do you want to explain how this works before we share our selections.
Absolutely. So I had a period doing some presenting on ABC Radio last year, and before that I was a regular guest on the Drive program, the show that you always wanted to be asked to be a guest on was called the Friday Knockoff here in ABC Hobart Radio, and they always had a little segment that they called the Rose, the Thorn and the Banana, and it was just a funny way to sort of think about what's been happening in your life or in your world for the past sort of week. So a rose is something good that you want to talk about. A thorn is something perhaps not so good that you want to raise awareness about. And the banana is just something a bit silly and fun. So because this is a retail program, Jason and I are not calling it Rose, Thorn and Banana. We're calling it a bargain, a rip-off and a gift with purchase. So every week, for as long as we think it's fun, Jason and I thought we might do this ourselves. So Jason, let's start with you. What is your bargain of the week?
My bargain or positive thing for retail this week is just that Victorian retail is open again.
Yay!
We mentioned it earlier on the show, but and you mentioned it, you know, that social experiential aspect, walking into a physical store and seeing a staff member and talking about products. I mean, some of the staff remembered us, like the people at Bond's Kids were like, oh, he must be back. I'm like, yeah, our son's grown a lot during this lockdown. We need all the bigger size. But it's just been so good. It's been so nice to go to physical shops, sit in cafes, and as we're recording this, we've just lost our what they were calling Ring of Steel. So we now have access to those regional towns and those really small boutique retailers in different locations that you're mentioning. So that's my big bargain of the week.
That's a great bargain, and they'll be happy to see you and everyone else that's coming into their stores. I love it. That's great. So my bargain is last week, I had an article published in The Conversation with a great guest of Shopology, Professor Gary Mortimer from QUT, and a new colleague of ours, Associate Professor Paul McGinn from the University of Western Australia. Now, Gary and Paul wrote sort of, I guess, part one in this series of two articles. So they published just prior an article called How COVID All But Killed the Australian CBD. You can read this on the Conversation website. And then as a part two, the three of us published together a follow-up which was called The Suburbs Are the Future of Post-COVID Retail. Now, this is obviously in as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic and the changes that we've seen with people working from home and what's going on in the CBD. Jason, we're going to interview Gary for our next episode, for episode three, about the changes that we're seeing taking place in city centres right around, well, the world, but in particular in Australia, and what that means for city retailers, for shoppers, and it sort of ties in, I guess, with our local shopping enthusiasm that you and I both have. So that was my bargain for the week. You can check out those articles on the Conversation website.
And speaking of a bargain, those articles are free to access. How about that? How's that?
They are. And if you haven't signed up for the Conversation email that comes into your inbox, I think it's every day now. It used to be, I think they've been, maybe it's because of the US election, but you can sign up online and get a free email into your inbox every day with all of the great stories that are published on the Convo. So, Jason, now time for something not so good, your rip-off of the week. What is your rip-off?
All right. So my rip-off of the week is, as reported by Dean Blake in Inside Retail, is that, you know, the newsagent WH Smith has finally started paying back some of what was estimated at $2.2 million that they had underpaid staff. Now, the paying back of the staff is not the rip-off. That's good. But the fact that we've seen so many examples in the past year of retailers and brands being found out for having underpaid their staff. And I think this really upsets me because the shop, you know, frontline shop floor staff are so crucial to retail and those experiential social aspects that we just mentioned before. And in my mind, they're, you know, they're really underpaid for what their role is and the way that that role is evolving, which I've written about for Inside Retail recently. And so that's my ripoff, is retailers underpaying their shop floor staff. We need to be celebrating these people, particularly what they've been through given all of the COVID pandemic. So pay them well and definitely don't illegally underpay them.
Hear, hear. Couldn't agree more. My ripoff is, well, I guess sort of linked to yours in a way, because WH Smith is a UK news agent. But my ripoff for the week is I'm thinking about all the retailers in the UK as that country has gone into lockdown again. Retailing in the UK employs more people than any other sector. It employs about 2.9 million people, and two-thirds of those employees work at the 75 largest companies. Now, as we've talked about previously on the pod, you know, retailing was wrestling with a lot of challenges even prior to COVID-19, and you've written about it, I've written about it, but this is all now just compounding a lot of the problems for UK retailers. The UK has, it already had the third highest level of online shopping in the world before COVID-19. And now that the country's gone into this lockdown, obviously that ability for people to be able to shop is going to be shifted to online. It's the worst possible time for those physical bricks and mortar stores in the UK in the lead up to Christmas. And what analysts are saying is that there's about 40% of UK retail space that's actually not needed. So that ties in, I guess, with the interview that we're going to do with Gary Mortimer for episode 3, is what's going to happen to all that space in the city? There's no way that it's all going to be turned into residential. There are lots of ideas that cities and towns are floating around, but I think what's interesting for me is that a lot of these decisions are going to have to happen much faster than they would have if we hadn't have had COVID-19. So watch this space. That's my ripoff for the week.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's such a tough time, particularly coming out of it now here for me in Melbourne. It's then strange to see places going into it or starting, because I guess we know what's to come in some ways, and I guess the only hope is that it can be, you know, shorter, because places can learn from each other and know what's happening, and hopefully some of the strategies that we've seen some of our retailers use to survive can help you know, internationally as well.
Absolutely. And finally, Jason, what is your gift with purchase? Something a little bit out of the ordinary and fun.
Yeah, so my little sort of gift with purchase, I guess, is that one of my PhD students, Beatrice Romano, I'll give a shout out, had a paper accepted recently about the role of augmented reality in retail, which is always nice when you have, you know, PhD students get to have papers accepted. What's really nice, I guess, as a little addition, is that she and I have just submitted that to be a feature article for Inside Retail. As you know, I do a monthly feature there, and I'm really passionate about, I guess, trying to share insights beyond, you know, outside of the academic paywalls that a lot of the academic journals have, so they can be accessed. And I think it was just a nice little win for, you know, to see a PhD student who's doing some research, it's relevant research, and here's a way that she can then share those insights with practitioners. So that was my little nice little surprising win.
No, that's great. Congratulations to you and Beatrice. And I mean, we're all about trying to get our research, as you say, out from behind the paywall of academic journals. And I guess that's one of the reasons that you and I are co-hosting the Shopology podcast, so that we can sort of share the things that we're doing to a broader audience. And speaking of that, my gift with purchase this week, and I probably do sound like I'm blowing our trumpet, but you know, that's fine.
It's our podcast, we can
blow our own trumpet. The Conversation yearbook comes out every year. Now, this is a collection of 50 articles that have been published the year previous. It's not articles that are the highest read. It's articles that are selected by the editor and of the overall yearbook and the editors of different sections on the convo. And Jason, you and I had an article selected for the yearbook this year. This was an article that was led by Professor Gary Mortimer and was written with our co-authors, Associate Professor Jana Bowden from Macquarie and Professor Martin Grimmer from University of Tasmania, where I am. And I just wanted to give a little shout out that this book is now available for sale. And it's a collection of 50 articles from the convo, as I said. It's called The Year That Changed Us. And some of the contributors include people like Michelle Grattan, Peter Martin, who's the editor of the Business and Economy section on the convo, Raina McIntyre, Peter Grester, and Professor Fiona Stanley. And it's been edited by Molly Glassie, who's the Conversations digital editor. And I guess my shout out is that it's available at all good local bookstores. Try and support local stores if you can, but it would make a fabulous Christmas gift. Yeah, so Jason, that's it.
We've done it. We've got through another episode. Look, it is always a pleasure to chat with you, Louise, and bring these insights to the broader industry and the broader public, as you mentioned before. And so I guess as we're establishing the show, we'd really love to hear from listeners and what they would like us to cover or any ideas for different topics. And so we really encourage everyone to subscribe and rate and review and do all of those kind of things to help us share it, but also reach out to us. You can find the show on Twitter at Shopology Show. You can also find me on Twitter at J.I. Palin. I'm also on LinkedIn. And Louise, people can find you across various channels as well.
Yes, I'm on Twitter all the time at Louise Grimmer, and on LinkedIn as well. And yes, please do subscribe to the show. And look, if you've got time, rate and review us. It doesn't take very long, but it really helps people find us. And look, Jason, it's been great to chat to you for episode 2. Thank you so much. And I just wanted to give a shout out to everyone in Melbourne, you and everyone else in Victoria and Melbourne, and especially to retailers. And I guess just to say to everyone, get shopping. Only how many weeks till Christmas? 6, 5, whatever it is.
It's arriving quickly. You've reminded me that I need to go and do my Christmas shopping. So let's wrap it up there, and then we can all go do our Christmas shopping, and we'll chat again soon.